More than 3,500 people were killed during the Troubles. Over 45,000 were seriously injured. It was a devastating loss of life, and for many families, the pain of those years has never gone away. In the decades since the Good Friday Agreement, Northern Ireland has found peace, but not always resolution. The question of how to deal with the past remains difficult, deeply contested, and often bitter. Should victims' families still hope for justice through the courts? Or has the chance for prosecutions passed, leaving only the possibility of truth if people are willing to tell it? One group of campaigners, north and south of the border, is proposing what they call a truth recovery process, an alternative to the legal system based on voluntary disclosure, mediation and reconciliation. To talk about this, I'm joined now by historian, journalist and trade unionist Padraig Yates. Welcome back to the programme, Padraig.
Now, thanks, Mark.
If you could start by explaining what you're proposing exactly to address the legacy of the Troubles and how it differs from previous attempts at reconciliation.
Yes, certainly. It's basically a conditional amnesty proposal whereby if people are willing to come forward who have information and to give it to victims and survivors, there should be a way of doing it. There should be a forum in which this could be done, which is mediation-based rather than the adversarial arena of a courtroom. And many people, myself included, have been in courts as reporters, as you know. We've all done that as journalists, but also as a witness, as a plaintiff, as a defendant. And the one thing I have never witnessed ever
is reconciliation.
No, I never felt as in the process of that. So what we're proposing is you have to, if you like, you have to disarm the various sides. You have to get them into a room to agree terms of engagement and look for the truth. And the deal, the quid pro quo, is that if people are willing to come forward and give information, there should be some way in which they can do so and give it, if they desire it, directly to families of the victims or to the victims themselves where they have survived. I'm not saying that is easy, but we think it's the only way of establishing the facts. Because fundamentally, if we cannot get reconciliation on the facts of what happened, getting reconciliation on anything else is very difficult and often very superficial.
So it's not like the South African truth and reconciliation process, which was very public. It's a kind of an ex-cathedra process. It's happening outside of the public gaze.
It is, but we do recommend that where people go through the process and they feel it was worthwhile doing and they're willing to do this, they should become advocates for the process, because we do think it can yield better results for society and for the individuals concerned than anything that will happen in a courtroom.
And this would include members of the security forces as well as paramilitaries?
Yes.
So that's kind of complicated by a certain piece of legislation that we'll perhaps talk about in a while. But it's not an adversarial process. It doesn't involve the courts, but it might involve judges, I think, would it?
Well, we accept there would have to be judicial oversight in some form or other. And like the Belfast Good Friday Agreement, we could have a situation where external judges, they could be appointed by the Irish and British governments. They could be appointed through some other body if they so wish, like the European Court, but there would be oversight. But the idea is that you wouldn't need to go to judges to get a judgment, to get at someone saying this is right and this is wrong. We would hope to overcome that. And there have been a few cases, individual cases, where people on their own initiative have done something similar. The only one I'm really aware of is the John Crawford case, who was a Catholic businessman, small businessman, in West Belfast, who was killed. It took some time to find out who did it. It turned out to be the UVF. And Winston Irvine, who's been in the news recently for other reasons, but he was a leading figure in the organisation, and he facilitated a truth recovery process. And both sides agreed, John Crawford on the family side and the UVF agreed on an approach that they were going to find out what happened and why it happened. They were not going to go into who did it and pursue justice in that form. He was willing to accept that system, and it's very close to what we're proposing. So that's the only example I can think of where people did that. But the trouble is, in the north, you have this huge machinery now, judicial machinery, And something like a third of all the lawyers in Northern Ireland are dependent to a greater or lesser extent on the courts for an income. So there's a huge lobby there for perpetuating the system. And what people instinctively do now, or you know, naturally do because of all the publicity, if they think they have a case involving themselves or a relative, they go and see a lawyer. And it goes straight into the legal process. But very, very few of these cases are going to be resolved. There's at least a thousand outstanding legacy cases. There's also the problem, and I'm aware of it, anyone who's had any involvement in this sort of thing is aware of it, where people have gone to prison, quite a number of people have gone to prison for things they didn't do because of the nature of a conflict. And what happens there is, particularly in the early years of the conflict, where an organisation would claim a killing, but say we killed so-and-so, they might even say it was C company of whatever organisation it was, loyalist or Republican. So immediately that narrows the circle of suspects. The police and the army go around rounding up people, bring them in. They get a confession out of somebody, or they get enough information or evidence to charge them. And that person really, the only defence they have is really to turn informer. Because if they don't, they can't just say, well,
they have to be able to finger who actually did it.
To get out of it themselves, yeah. That dilemma, they have to say, it wasn't me, it was him.
And the rationale on the part of the security forces is, okay, we're banging this person up for something they didn't do, but they probably did something anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. And which is possibly true too, but yes, you know, it's the nature of the conflict. And that conflict was a communal conflict. It wasn't a discrete crime. It wasn't a man murdering his wife or someone robbing a bank and shooting the teller in the process. This was planned, premeditated usually, and there were quite a number of people involved. But the people who end up in the dock, and the same applies with security forces, is usually the person who pulls the trigger or who plants the bomb. It's not the person who ordered it. And that is the big, we think, injustice in the whole system.
Because there's a conspiracy involved, and yes. Conspiracy is a crime.
Yeah, absolutely.
And are you talking?
But it's a very hard crime to prove.
It is very, very hard to prove. You're talking about if people do come forward and they have information and they volunteer that information, would they be subject to an amnesty, or would it just be the case that whatever testimony they give in whatever forum they give that testimony could not be used against them? They couldn't incriminate themselves.
Well, yes, there's a process which is long established called protected disclosure. Mm. So if you come forward under protected disclosure process, that information you give cannot be used against you.
So it's whistleblower legislation.
In that sense, it is. But in fact, that it has been very successful in retrieving the bodies of the missing, the disappeared. Most of them have been retrieved through that process because people came forward. And interestingly enough, nobody so far has been charged, let alone convicted, on the basis of information that came through protected disclosure. So the system does work. And what we're trying to do is bridge the gap between protected disclosure and some form of amnesty that would be, you know, compliant with European law, but would also give people the space to engage with each other as well as with the courts, instead of the courts or instead of the, if you like, the institutions of the state.
Now, there's a piece of legislation which might interfere with the process that you're talking about, and that's the short term for it is the Legacy Act. It's the Northern Ireland Troubles Legacy and Reconciliation Act, to give it its full title, introduced by the Tory government, now being amended by the Labour government. Explain how it was supposed to work and how it differs from your proposals and how it might interfere with, perhaps, with your proposals.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm subject to correction on this. But my understanding of it is that it was aimed primarily at dealing with the security forces problem. So where soldiers come forward and give evidence, again, truthfully, they will then be dealt with more leniently than would be the case if they were simply arrested and charged on suspicion and had to go through the whole gamut of the legal process. But there's a number of problems with it. The most important one, I suppose, is simply that there's no faith in it. There's no confidence that it will work because people in the North assume the system is loaded in favour of the soldiers. And also the very idea, well, if you own up and say, yes, I killed somebody, it offends against people's sense of justice. Because you've owned up to it, you can walk away. And the problem is that, unfortunately, given the antagonism in the North, given the depth of feeling in the North, it's an incendiary way of trying to deal with the problem, which was devised by people who probably are not that aware or sensitive to the issues involved. I mean, we did meet with the Northern Ireland office on a number of occasions, and in fact, they filched, if you like, some of our ideas from us, which they then regurgitated in this act. But they're fundamentally different because we take it out of the legal forum. But it is based on people opting into it. That is the first hurdle, if you like, has to be overcome. If people come forward and say, yes, I have information on the deaths of so-and-so, or a bombing that caused a lot of injury, the families, at least one member of the family has to say, yes, I am willing to go down this route.
And what has been the reception for your ideas in London, Dublin and Belfast on an official level, a governmental level?
None, really, basically, to be honest. We've had good engagement with the Northern Ireland office, but I suppose they've more skin in the game than anybody else. But we have met with them, been very impressed by them. They've asked us a lot of questions and they've incorporated some of our ideas into their legislation. We've had very little engagement in the South. I think the Dublin government and the Department of Foreign Affairs think, well, it's really a problem for the Brits. And they've, up until now, until the OMA inquiry, I suppose, they've kept a good distance from it. And they're still pursuing this member state case against the British government, which creates sort of clear water between them and the Brits about what's going on up there. And we're really nothing to do with it.
This is the legacy. I mean, they're basically challenging
the Legacy Act, yes.
Which I suppose in a way puts them in an invidious position as far as your approach is concerned. Has there been a paramilitary response? Have you approached former paramilitaries?
Yeah. Yeah. When we did set it up, we're a very small group. But we approached various people. We had six people who agreed to participate in this process if it was established by the two governments, and they would take part. And a couple of them had a lot of information. That was in the winter of 2018, 2019, when we first kicked this idea around. So we set up our small group. It's a company limited by guarantee. We've no funding from anybody apart from ourselves. Unfortunately, since then, two of them have died of cancer. One has died of COVID and one has dementia. We haven't gone looking for more people. There's no point because unless there is a process, a willingness to engage, you know, and the reality is, I think the reality is that the permanent government, North and South, and a lot of the politicians take the easy option, which is just string it out until everyone's dead and then we can forget about it.
And there is a time element here, because one of the interesting things is that I think more than half of the casualties or fatalities anyway are pre-1976.
That's
so
right.
We're talking about more than almost 50 years.
Sure, the worst years, the early 70s. It was a period of internment, basically, and there was no real law in the normal sense, but simply by having internment, you had military dictatorship, in a sense. Anyone could be lifted off the streets and was. I mean, there's some peculiar things have emerged. I'll give you an example. I know two people, and there's far more than, but I know two people who were both contacted by large legal practices and told, you know, you are entitled to compensation for your time, for some of your time in prison. And they were mystified because they sort of was open and shut, really, cases. And they explained to this lad who was done for conviction for possession of a terrorist weapon, for example, that when he was arrested, he was 17 and he was detained in the Mays prison. And then he was convicted and then he served the sentence. But the period from his arrest up until his 18th birthday, he was illegally detained and therefore he was entitled to compensation.
So, well, obviously a lot of legal firms are doing quite a lot of research. I mean, you know, we would call this in other contexts ambulance chasing, would we?
Well, you might, yes. I mean, this is a problem. When people get a mindset, this is the way to go, this is how things should be done, then other people pile in and say, yes, well, we can fine-tune it in this way or improve it in that way. So, yes, that is the problem. Now, don't emphasise that too much because, A, I don't annoy the legal profession too much, but B, we need an alternative to the courts. You cannot, after any large-scale conflict, as you know yourself as a historian, that at some point the curtain has to be pulled down.
Yeah, I mean, in 1921, the curtain was, 22, the curtain was pulled down. 1924, after the Civil War, the same thing, the curtain was pulled down.
Yes, otherwise we couldn't have had the degree of reconciliation such as it was that happened after that.
If we can talk a little bit about a couple of your own experiences and apply them to this situation. I mean, in a truth recovery process, it's a process that you yourself could take part in because you, 1,000 years ago, were a member of the IRA.
Yes, I joined, that's my excuse. I joined the movement when I was 17. I was recruited to the IRA when I was 18. When the split came in 69-70, I stayed with what became known as the officials. Most people I think I knew or was aware of stayed with the official movement. And really, the Provosts were born out of Belfast and out of the pogroms in 69. That's where their origins lie. And they grew from there, and they had a very, initially very simplistic approach. They developed it since, I first to acknowledge that. And we didn't get anywhere because we basically tried to apply class politics, you know, the old Wolfe Tone unity of Catholic, Protestant and dissenter, to look for equal economic and social justice.
And you were on ceasefire from 1972.
There was a brief interval with that in 74. But apart from that, yes. But the other interesting thing I did notice when I started doing this, one of the reasons I started doing it, is that I realised I knew 31 people whose names I could recollect who were killed violently in the Troubles. And I was amazed. Only two of them were killed by loyalists, I think, or two or three were killed by loyalists, sorry, three. Five were killed by the British Army, and all the others were Republicans killed by other Republicans in the feuds. A lot of people died after the bloodiest period. I mean, for the internal feuds amongst Republicans, you know, 75 was a bad year. 76 was a bad year. I think the last serious one was around 78. And some people who were dead almost certainly died in internal rows that nobody knows the details of who wasn't involved.
And in your specific case, though, to some extent, your very, very early involvement as a very, very young man comes back in 2019 in the Ballymurphy 10 inquest. You were asked to give evidence. You didn't have to, but you did.
Well, I was summoned. I mean, I don't think they're going to extradite me if I didn't turn up. But I was summoned then out of courtesy to the court. And I did explain to the judge's, the coroner's office, that I felt I had very little to contribute because it was 50 years ago. And I didn't know Belfast well at the time. In fact, Ballymurphy was in darkness for a lot of the time because there was no public lighting. It had all been wrecked in previous riots. But I gave my evidence to the best of my ability. And I found myself being sort of threatened with contempt because some of the information I gave was given to me by someone I'd met subsequently who was a loyalist. And one of the reasons I went and gave evidence is because a number of other people said, well, look, if you give evidence and it works, and we might give evidence. So when I went into the court, I knew there were other people in the courtroom or people on the grapevine who would hear afterwards what had happened, who would be interested to see what happened to me. So when I was confronted basically by one of the lawyers for two of the families, I was persistently asked to name my source, who this person was. And of course, I had to refuse and explain to the judge I'd given my word. But eventually, the judge obviously didn't want to lock me up and derail, you know, an important process over this fairly minor row, really, as I saw it. And I think she saw it. So I said to her, look, if she gave me, you know, the capacity, the facility to do it, I would go and I would try and persuade the person concerned to come forward and give evidence themselves rather than rely on what I had to say. And she accepted that. And I did make an attempt, not very successful. I think I knew that and the judge knew that, but I did that. But it just underlined the whole point that the lawyers
didn't encourage the others to come forward.
One of them actually came back to me afterwards and said, look, he said, appreciate what you're trying to do there. I said, but it's not going to work. So they didn't give evidence. I don't know how good or bad that evidence would have been. So we'll just never know. But that is the problem people face. You go into court and you go into court, you give an affidavit, you are nailed to that affidavit. You stray from it by one word or one sentence, And they said, well, hold on, you said on the oath here, you know, are you now saying, are you a liar? Are you making this up? You know, so it's just, it's such a bizarre, I mean, this is a system devised back in the Middle Ages to end blood feuds. And we're still using the same process 1,000-odd years later. And I just think it's madness when you're dealing with a very complex social problem. It's not just individual crimes by individual people. It's society at war with itself. And I don't know about you, but I never realised that fear was such an infectious, you know, emotion until you're there. And suddenly, you know, people say, they're coming. And you don't have to say, well, who are they? Or what are they coming for? People just know they're coming, and this is a problem, and someone has to deal with it. And people would cry out for defence by somebody, and it doesn't matter who it is, they need someone to stand up for them at that moment in time. A week later, they may regret it deeply and say, I wish I'd never spoken to those people, I wish I didn't know them. But that's the problem.
Yeah. Well, the truth recovery process is one proposal to deal with the legacy of the Troubles, whether that's possible or welcome is for victims, survivors, and I suppose for society to decide. You can read more about these arguments and coverage of this debate over truth and reconciliation on the website truthrecoveryprocess.ie. My guest is Páirí Gates. Páirí, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Miles.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath on sound and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.